Hello and welcome to the North Star. I'm your host, David Perel, the founder of North Star Media, and this is the North Star Podcast. This show is a deep dive into the stories, habits, ideas, strategies, and rituals that guide fulfilled people and create enormous success for them. And while the guests are diverse, they share profound similarities. They're guided by purpose, live with intense joy, learn passionately, and see the world with a unique lens. With each episode, we get to jump into their minds, soak up their hard-earned wisdom, and apply it to our lives.
My guest today is Austin Reith, the co-founder and chief operating officer of Morning Brew, a daily email newsletter with the latest news from Wall Street to Silicon Valley. Austin started the company back when he was a student at the University of Michigan, and now Morning Brew has more than 1 million subscribers. This conversation is about all things email, from growth to retention to strategy. We talk about Morning Brew's early growth strategies, its ever-growing referral program, and the power of exclusive content for loyal subscribers. And then we talk about my own Monday Musings newsletter, my online course called Rite of Passage, and how people like you and me can harness the power of email. When it comes to media and commerce, Austin is one of my very favorite people to talk to. And in fact, the first time I met Austin, we had such a good conversation about the future of commerce that right after we just canceled our plans for the evening and turned the conversation into an article called The Pivot to Owned Commerce. And we brought that energy right into this conversation. I hope you enjoy this episode.
So Jason Stein was on the podcast a couple weeks ago now, and he brought this concept up, and I think it is a huge thing that's coming where you can no longer just be a growth marketer or a company, you know, the eighth mattress company or the 12th comforter company and think that you're going to come into the market with the ordinary Facebook, Instagram, podcast, newsletter ecosystem and be successful. I think there are two ways product and marketing can come together. One is actually in your marketing. So having some sort of unique marketing component or something that is different from everyone else. And a lot of people did that. So you look at maybe like Credit Karma with some of their calculators they had back in the day when they were growth hacking SEO. That's interesting. But I think now it's more truly the integration of your core product with your marketing efforts. A good example is like Everlane. So they launched a partnership with the New York Times where they put their the New York Times slogans on Everlane clothes. And it's just so genius because, number one, you're going to sell out. If you promote the New York Times slogans, New York Times members, it's such an organic fit. But also, it's a great partnership where people at people who subscribe to New York Times learn what Everlane is. People who don't subscribe to New York Times who are in Everlane CRM or people in their email list end up potentially subscribing to New York Times. And there's no need to promote that. It promotes itself, right? The New York Times is going to promote it. It's going to sell, and you don't need to market that. And so that's a combination of your product team coming together. How can we make a unique experience based on the marketing channel? And so it's diverting attention dollars from the traditional Facebook, Instagram, which are getting so competitive. I'm always just given, we run a media company, we talk to direct consumer marketers all the time. And we constantly hear, things are getting tough out there. And it's because your product is not any better than anyone else's. And people are able to find these underpriced opportunities in Instagram ads, in Facebook ads, and they're just not out there anymore. Everyone's there. Big companies are going there. And so it's going to be about being unique and bring product and marketing together with unique things. And Jason brought up the example, I think, of the Samsung folding phone.
Yeah.
That's great, right? I mean, it markets itself. Allbirds has done some unique stuff with some wildlife preservation, organizations.
Supreme in the New York transportation, right? Remember they had those subway cars?
Exactly.
With the Supreme logo on the back, and everyone was like going to those subway turnstiles trying to get one.
Yeah, and even one of our competitors, Market Snacks, got acquired by Robinhood. It's really smart. Robinhood, it's a step into content marketing. I think it's going to be tough for them to really leverage the Market Snacks brand. But for Robinhood, makes a ton of sense. You have 6 million people on the platform who are trading, but they're not daily active users. And so acquiring a daily newsletter is a way to keep them daily active in at least your ecosystem. Now, how they leverage that to convert people into Robinhood traders, whether their goal is to get them to trade more per day or put more into their Robinhood account, it's a constant reminder about the the investment world. I think it's really smart. There's going to be more of that in the marketplace.
And now every example that you gave, I think, had to do with novelty. So does the product and marketing only happen around novelty, or are there certain examples where then the product is so good and the user experience is so great that then the marketing goes and works for itself?
Yeah, so I'll give you two examples. I'll give you a personal example.
Okay.
With Morning Brew. We have the referral program. Every person who's signed up to the newsletter has a referral link. That is a viral mechanism built into the newsletter. We are constantly reminding you, share the newsletter, earn prizes. And without that, we may have some word of mouth growth, but this is just such a constant reminder. We're giving you something. It's just built perfectly together. Every person who signs up gets a referral link. We have tested when you get access to what, which products, which swag you get. And I think that's a decent, it's not perfect, but it works very well. Mm-hmm. You get swag for sharing the newsletter. Then think about even like Away. I think Away is a great example. I think it's underrated, the fact that you can get so many consultants traveling Monday morning, 6 a.m. Consultants get on the plane, they look up at the where you put your suitcase, everyone's Away. If you don't have an Away, you look around, mm-hmm. and it's just Away. It's maybe blue, black, pink, purple, whatever, but it's the same exact suitcase. I think it's just such a unique product. It's not novel. It's not a novelty, but I do think it is such a good-looking product and such a concentration of that product in one space, whether it's on a plane, on the belt, when you go pick up your luggage. So I think they, whether it's intentional or not, kind of growth hacked that, whereas Casper, a mattress company, you don't show off your mattress to people. It's there's no marketing built in the product there. And that's why I think things in the home are going to be a bit tougher to grow, because you don't brag about your mattress. You don't really brag about your sheets. But you talk about your suitcase when you're waiting around in the airport with tons of people.
And so what's the implication here? Is the implication here what you're saying is that the opportunity to go out and raise $5 to $8 million, have a commodity product, and then just flood Facebook and Instagram with advertising units, is that then gone? Or what is the actual implication in terms of what you're saying? How is that going to look for the future of direct-to-consumer and a lot of these product businesses?
I don't think it's gone. I think people are still going to do it, and there's there's capital out there. People are going to raise money. I think they're going to struggle to succeed. So I'm talking to companies, and it used to be Facebook and Instagram worked really well for us for 2 years, but we're hitting diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking to companies who just raised their Series A, and now they're coming out and saying Facebook and Instagram are struggling, and we're seeing diminishing returns. And it's like, didn't you just turn that on 2 months ago? So it's just more saturated. Costs are higher. CPMs are going up. The ad customers are getting more accustomed to these ad units, and it's a question of how quickly can Facebook and Instagram evolve, or can a Snapchat get good enough? And right now their platform is not good enough for, at least for us and a lot of people we're talking to. It's a pretty cheap opportunity. I think it's more brand marketing, but it's not good enough. And so ultimately, I think they're going to, like I said, they're going to be companies that come out there, and those companies are going to raise the money, but I think it's going to be very, very tough. Your model just changes. Your growth model changes when your costs go up 50, 60%. And you just can't spend the capital because it's so competitive.
So then what's your pitch when you go talk to advertisers? You have an email ad unit, you have X number of subscribers, Y number open rate. What is your pitch when you go talk to them? They come to you, they say, yo, Austin, help us out here. We just raised our Series A. We're struggling to have Facebook ads go work for us. How do you respond to them?
Yeah, it depends who it is. Let's go, it's a direct to consumer. We give you a different ad, it's native, so it's a different ad unit. It's not a banner. It's not the same imagery you're using in your programmatic on Google, your programmatic on Facebook, even your billboards. It's a different type of ad. It's text ad. And therefore, it's very native in our tone. So we're coming to you and saying, hey, people, you know, a million plus people come read our content every day, and we're going to give, so it's scale. There's definite scale there. It's not Facebook and Instagram, but it definitely is scale.
Yeah,
and we're going to hit these people with content that we know they like because they come back to the newsletter every day, and we're going to hit it with our tone, our style, and we still offer some A/B testing. We offer, you know, you can do a few things. It's the targeting is not as good as Facebook, but these companies are seeing it back out from an ROI perspective, and it allows them to spend less money on Facebook and Instagram. So we've seen some direct consumers scale to well in the six figures with us per year because they're seeing good results, because the native ad does work. It works much better than a banner that the New York Times or other people put in their newsletters.
And now what then prevents companies like yourself going to launch product companies? I mean, we've seen this tried where you've had BuzzFeed try to launch their Commerce Studios, Tasty. They came out with that stove that was really cool. But then why wouldn't this be happening more? You know, it sounds like if you're going to get free organic advertising and you already have the built-in channel and you start with content instead of product, you build an audience, then you come back to product rather than starting with product and then trying to build an audience. What's stopping these companies from launching products?
There certainly are some doing it. Glossier is the best example. Billion-dollar company now based on that. I think it fits best for a lifestyle brand. Mm-hmm. So I think that's tough. We're a news company, right? So we're definitely not. We may have a lifestyle component, but we are not giving you new lifestyle recommendations. So it's so organic. Say, hey, Glossier was giving recommendations off of what makeup to wear. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert, a makeup expert, but they were giving, you know, with Into the Gloss, I believe that's what it's called.
Yeah.
So it's so organic. Say, hey, here's the routines we've been pushing. Now use our products. It's a little less organic for a media company like Morning Brew to say, hey, here are the top five news stories of the day. Buy this makeup. With that being said, I still think there's an opportunity for media companies, and they're trying, right? Thrillist and Jack Threads did it. But I think the big thing is you need to have true brand affinity. So people need to actually come to your content, not because they found it in Google. And so if you just, if a company like BuzzFeed tries to just weave in a product recommendation that they own into a top 10 recommendation article, people aren't going to resonate with that list, with that product.
What do you call this? Need versus feed?
Yeah, need versus feed. Yeah. So it just, we are a need product. People opt in, they come back to us every day. You look at a company like Fuck Jerry, launch What Do You Mean? Well, they are a feed company.
Okay.
People seek out their content. People really, you see with their engagement, they have really high engagement. And so they hinge on lifestyle, entertainment. Very easy for them to organically create a board game. A lot of companies are doing this. Jungle Creation, mm-hmm. They launch socks. I saw an article up to $1 million a month. Bleacher Report, working with Dwayne Wade on some clothing lines. So it has to be a good fit. It has to be organic. But also, you have to have people who care about what you're saying. If people don't care about what you're saying, you're not going to be able to launch anything. I mean, even ads. You're going to struggle with ads if no one really cares what you're writing about, what you're talking about, what you're preaching in your newsletter or on your website.
And so just to anchor what you just said in terms of need versus feed, what a need product is it's a company that you go out, you go search that product, and you say, I need this. This is a brand that I really relate to. And then on the flip side, a feed company is one that you find in Facebook or Instagram. You don't have such affinity for that product or that brand. Really what's happening is it's showing up in feeds. And so you have to depend on the randomness of algorithms for that product to then be shown to you. And then you could get into some of the media companies that have struggled, and like Mike, which was sold in the fire sale. Part of the reason that they've struggled is they haven't been able to transition from a feed to a need company. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I definitely think that's accurate. So in general, okay. Directionally, I would say opt in products, media products, so newsletters and podcasts are more need based.
Okay.
Just in general, you opt into a newsletter, you opt into a podcast. I think there are some exceptions. So if you've ever considered searching for an Instagram account, that's a need. So I search for House of Highlights.
Mm, like, hey, that's a good one.
House of Highlights is absolutely a
crushed
need.
Crushed it. Yeah.
I use House of Highlights to get my product my sports recommendations.
Yeah.
So what to watch? They're now even doing some of the stuff that I think it's Overtime's doing, where they're covering high school players. Mm-hmm. So LeBron and Melo and Dwayne Wade were all watching. I think it was Dwayne Wade's son playing basketball. And it encouraged you to go out and watch that. So there's an absolute need. I think Barstool is a lot of need-based content. People search for Dave Portnoy's pizza reviews.
Oh,
and pardon my take. So I think there are some exceptions. I think Fuck Jerry is another one. People love their content. But I think for the most part, if you are native to a platform, it's nice to engage with you, but it's not a need.
Yeah. So I want to switch gears a bit and just ask, how the hell did you start Morning Brew? Like, let's go back to the story. You now have 1 million email subscribers, a company with more than 20 people based in New York City. And you started this when you were at the University of Michigan in college. Walk me through this story. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. So my co-founder, Alex Lieberman, was helping some friends with interview prep. And he discovered from that that people really struggled to resonate with the business world. Mm-hmm. So people were reading some of the content out there because they felt like they had to, not because they wanted to. And so we said, this is ridiculous. Alex started writing an email newsletter. I joined him very early on, and it just took off in Michigan. Word of mouth. We hit the ground running, going to clubs, classes, flyering. We one by one, probably at the first 1,000 people signed up. From that, we got our friends to replicate that at other Big Ten schools, Penn State, Indiana, et cetera. Got to about 12 to 15,000. I went to go work at an investment banking job for a summer. Alex graduated, worked at Morgan Stanley, and we both decided finances and for us, we want to help educate the future leaders of the business world. It's a mission we could get behind. I graduated, moved to New York, started Morning Brew. We had no idea what we were doing. Hired someone on editorial, hired someone on tech.
And how big were you at this point? Because the last number you said was 12 to 15,000, and now all of a sudden you're in New
York. So a year later, so that was the following summer, about 50, 60,000. We grew to 100,000 in January 1st, 2018, and then the next 12 months were crazy. It was a blur. We went from 100,000 to 1 million we hit mid-February. So 13 months, we 13x'd. Yeah. So it was insane growth from the team. We went from 4 people to 12, 13. Now we're going to be 20 midsummer. We went from virtually $0 of revenue in 2017 to we exceeded $3 million in 2018. And we'll 3x that at least in 2019. So by focusing on one product, we were really able to create the best email newsletter out there. We create what I believe is the best daily newsletter in terms of content. We have the best growth mechanisms possible to grow that. And we have a sales team that has unbelievable brand partnerships that we have the privilege of working with: Fidelity, Morgan Stanley, Mattress Company. You know, we work with the full gamut of fintech companies. We work with everyone. And it's great because we can give you different type of ads, really high quality content. We can be selective with our advertising partners. And together, we built one of, if not the most successful daily newsletter out there.
So I want to go through with you of the key parts of that journey and talk about what it's like to grow a business when you're in college and you have no idea what you're doing and you're spending Fridays and Saturdays probably going out and boozing and eating, what are those really good Zingerman deli sandwiches at University of Michigan? No. So Zingerman, the guy who started that deli, spoke at my college.
Really?
And he's a cool dude.
Yeah, they've written a bunch of books.
Yeah. And so he spoke at Elon, and I remember his talk so well because he was talking about the user experience of eating that sandwich.
Yeah.
And what he talks about is how the sauce flows down your forearm along your veins down to your elbow and how most people would see that as a bug, but he sees it as a feature to make it memorable. And I just have never forgotten his speech. So I'm doing a trip to Ann Arbor soon, and that's my first stop.
Yeah, you have to. Their Reuben is very good.
That's what I've heard. Okay, so you're in college. You're doing whatever you're at Zingerman's Deli, you're maybe skipping class to work on Morning Brew. How did you stumble into Morning Brew? And did you know that email was this incredible channel? You know, you've learned a lot about email. What were those early years like?
Yeah, it's interesting. So Alex started the email. He started it – when he started, it was a PDF attachment. And it's funny. There was a clip art bull and bear on it. It was about as ugly as it gets. And there was no way to sign up. So infinite friction. The way to sign up was you had to discover what Alex's email was.
Oh, no.
Send him an email. Hey, Alex, my name is blank. I saw David reading this thing. It's not even really a newsletter. It's a PDF attachment. What is that? Can you sign me up? And Alex then went, sure, and added your name in the two line the next day. And I was one of those 200 to 300 people, let's say, who did that. And he sent out an email one day saying, hey, I'm getting a little traction here. Would someone want to join me? I was pretty fixated on going into investment banking, but I thought entrepreneurship's interesting. This idea to me has legs, did a little bit of research, reached out to him, and we just took off running from there. But it was a side project. It was a, we both thought we were going to finance. And counterintuitively, that's what helped make us so successful, is that there was no weight of being successful. There was no risk. We were just creating a it was a side project. It was fun. It was for our friends, for our fraternity, hopefully for a few if a few people at the business school got value out of it, that was great for us. So every decision, we didn't overthink anything, which I think we actually do now, where a lot of people just overthink things because there's the weight of millions of dollars of revenue and employees. But we just went out and said, yeah, we'll try this name. If it doesn't work, we'll change the name later. Who really cares? And at the time, it didn't matter. We had 300 subscribers. But we went out and just started telling people about it. And I got pretty serious with it, where I was not going out some nights as a side project, working on this, getting pretty serious about it. We started growing it, and we really did see some traction. And it's funny, I had the email notification set up for the longest time, where every single person who signed up, I got an email, and I would go through it all day long. That's all I would do, refresh my phone. I was addicted. I was really addicted. And every person who unsubscribed, I saw who you were.
Missed, yeah. Damn it.
I was like, oh, three unsubscribes. Now we have hundreds of people unsubscribe every day. But I would see every person. And so we start Googling and LinkedIning.
That's a word. We can make it up.
We would start reach out to every person who signed up. Hey, how'd you hear about it? And I look up one guy, and his name is Alan Murray. Alan Murray at the time, I believe, was the editor-in-chief of Time Magazine. A few months later, he became the chief content officer of Time Inc. He's now the CEO of Fortune, I believe.
And was one of your first subscribers.
He doesn't know he signed up for it. I can't remember. But we talked to him, and he said, just keep going. He said, this has legs. There is a need for this. You know, you are really filling a need with young business professionals who need quick conversational business news.
When did you realize that this wasn't going to be a side project and was something a little bit more serious than that?
I think we hit 10,000 subscribers. And now 10,000 subscribers means nothing. But we hit 10,000, and we just said, this has some room to run. We had enough people who enjoyed the newsletter enough, who sought out the newsletter. We just said, there's something there. It was still a side project, but it was a little bit more.
And then you're going to different Big Ten schools. You're basically, to use a Paul Graham quote, you're doing things that don't scale. What is the craziest marketing thing that you did?
So I have a bit of a funny story. So, and I got to find this email. I think it's on my old computer. I don't even think my email searches back this far. But long story short, Alex and I would get up every morning pretty early, and we'd print out thousands of flyers.
Were you roommates at this point?
No, we weren't roommates, okay. But we live very close together. We'd print out flyers, we'd cut them up, and we'd put them all over the business school. Five per table, hundreds of tables, every desk, thousands of flyers every single day. Every night, the cleaning crew would clean them up. Well, the next morning, we go back at it every single day. We then went to raise a little bit of money. There were some student funds, MBA funds, and we're BBAs. At the Michigan Business School, there's a little bit of tension between the MBAs and the BBAs. Nothing crazy, but it's definitely there because there's so many MBAs and so many BBAs. So I reached out to one of the funds. I said, hey, would love to speak in front of you, tell you what we're doing, see if we can raise a little bit of money. And the guy, the president of the fund, responds, due to your complete utter disrespect by trashing the business school, I cannot even consider making an investment in Morning Brew. Well, the funny thing was, at the time, we would have given away half the company for a few pennies.
Oh, my God.
So
goodness.
That fund would have returned who knows what. But it
would
was
have been the Austin Reeves School of Business. Yeah, you would have overtaken Stephen Ross.
Exactly. but it's funny. Michigan ended up investing with another fund, which is a bit ironic there. But it's just an interesting story because we we certainly didn't, I took that as prideful. It's like, oh, this guy's noticing our flyers. Great, let's keep on doing it. If he didn't see our flyers, maybe we'd have stopped. But Alex and I said, you know what? There's a need for this, and there's no reason that we can't flyer. It's not a big deal. But also, it was motivation. You know, this MBA is so cocky. I need to find out his name and email him. But he was so cocky and so pompous. They used to send that condescending email. It was pretty funny at the time. We were kind of scared, but now looking back, it's hysterical.
Granted, the cleaning crew was probably like, who is this guy? They probably felt like Sisyphus climbing a hill, psh, coming back with your flyers every morning. So you're the growth guy, and you're like, okay, we're actually going to take this really seriously now. This is more than a side project, more than a part-time project. This is a company now, and I'm responsible for growth. What do you do?
Yeah, so I was fortunate. It wasn't just me. So I had Tyler. He's still on the team. He does product now, but he was also helping with growth. He was more in the weeds. But we said, we're going to test everything. We're going to be very smart about testing it, very small tests. We're going to be very stingy, but we're going to figure out ways to grow. So we tested the basic stuff, Facebook and Instagram. It worked pretty well. We had that referral program from day one. So we knew if we can spend as much time as possible on that, we can afford to miss on some paid acquisition opportunities, because even if our CACs are, let's say, 40% higher, if they can bring with them new subscribers with the referral program, we have a buffer. And that was always our worst case scenario. Worst case scenario, we expose this referral program to other people, and so there's virality built in. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for that referral program, we wouldn't be here today. That allowed us we raised a little angel round, but with very little capital, really kick off growth. So we did some Facebook and Instagram. We did some Snapchat. One big thing for us was newsletter sponsorship. So we sponsored other newsletters.
Okay.
Basic idea was, I want to pick a newsletter that is not a competitor. Pocket. Pocket is an example. So Pocket, if you don't know what it is, it's a Chrome extension. You can save an article for later. They send out a newsletter every day with an ad in it. What we said was, or our hypothesis was, if you are passionate enough about Pocket to sign up, mm-hmm. then you read the newsletter, their newsletter every day, you must be a curious person.
Yes.
But then if you read an ad about another newsletter, click on that and then convert to that newsletter, you're probably going to be a high quality subscriber. And it turned out those are very high quality subscribers. So we did that, and that worked very well. But the majority of the time was the referral program. A-B testing every single subject line of every automated email. A-B testing every single, the body of every email. The prizes when you get these emails. And we still do it now. Mm-hmm. So it's never over. We're still testing.
So now you're getting into industry newsletters.
Yeah. So the basic idea around that is, well, it's two things. One, we got so many inbound emails from people saying, I love Morning Brew. I love the tone. I love the format. But I work in marketing. I would love Morning Brew for marketing. Or I work in retail. I love Morning Brew for retail, et cetera, et cetera. And so we said, well, our core competency is creating really high quality, well-designed emails. Mm-hmm. Let's take what we do best and do more of it. And that's what we're doing. So we launched Morning Brew Emerging Tech about 2 months ago now. It's approaching the six figure subscriber mark. And every 2 to 3 months, approximately, we're going to launch other industries. So we're launching retail coming up in a few months. And we're going to test a few other industries as well. And the hope is that not only can we go an inch deep and a mile wide and cover the holistic business world with Morning Brew's core newsletter, but you can also be served with deeper content in the areas in which either you're interested in mm-hmm. or work in mm-hmm. with these industry newsletters. I think it's great from a business standpoint. While it's still ad revenue, which we're not diversifying outside ad revenue yet, it still certainly is revenue diversification. It's new partners hitting a more targeted audience, the people they want to hit, and there's so many synergies. Our email platform, sales team, growth team.
And now tell me, so you mentioned that you launch a new newsletter and within 2 months you have 100,000 subscribers.
Approaching, yeah.
Approaching. So tell me, how do the dynamics of building a new newsletter happen? Because obviously you've been able to scale that really quickly. So are you promoting the new ones in the main Morning Brew newsletter, or how is that actually happening? Curious to hear your strategy as the growth guy.
Yeah, so emerging tech's a bit of a unicorn. It's such a buzzwordy, everyone loves that phrase, emerging technology, blockchain, AI. And so I don't think any of the other ones are going to grow at the pace at which that one grew. But a few plugs in the newsletter and we're up to 50, 60K. And then what we encourage people to do, and we are going to be launching our same referral program for industry newsletters. By the time this podcast airs, it'll probably be out. We encourage people, hey, you work at Google, share with your friends at Google. My speculation is on a percent basis, the referral programs would be more powerful within industries because if we prompt you, hey, you work in retail, share in your retail Slacks, your retail Facebook groups, your office, mm-hmm. your coworkers. Mm-hmm. It's everything's about social currency. Knowing about the industry is as much for your own knowledge as it is to show off in front of a client or a colleague. And so if I can say, hey, I know about all this, you can learn too by signing up to Retail Brew. It's compelling, and I think we're going to get people to really share it in these offices, and that's the goal. The goal is to spread across Amazon and Walmart and those big box retailers.
Yeah, I really like what you just said about the social currency of knowing about your industry, and I think that when you work on a project like this, you really get into the psychology behind why are people opening up my newsletter? Why is this a daily thing? Why do people care so much about what I'm saying? And I went through this with my own newsletter, Monday Musings. I was like, why is this so popular? I now have 8,000 subscribers with like a 60% open rate. And I'm like, why? And what I realized as I began to talk to people, I did what you did. I started asking people, hey, why do you enjoy Monday Musings? And what people told me is it gives me something to talk about, which makes me look smart.
Yep.
And it's just the little nuggets. They're short enough to be memorable, but long enough to be substantial enough that people hear them and they're like, whoa, you read something really interesting. And that social signaling is massively powerful.
Yeah, well, I think the hottest thing out today is carrying a book or giving off the impression that you read. People love looking smart, whether you read or not. What I'll say is, not the people who say the people who say they read and how much they read, it's mathematically not possible for that to be true, given books are declining. Like we just see, there's no way every person who says, "Oh, I read 20 books this year, 30 books this year." Yeah, ask them to name three or four books they read. Some people, sure, they read a lot. I try to read a good amount, but all of friends, yeah, I read. I read for sure. I'll be like, what's the name of the last three books you read? And they'll be like, Huck Finn. Like, you read Huck Finn in 11th grade. And so a lot of people don't actually read. They say they read. But it's the same idea. The same idea is to look smart, to have social currency. I did this. I read that. It's a lot of what Twitter is.
I will say, though, so my favorite consumer behavior analysis happens not from surveys, not from books, not from podcasts, but from looking over people's shoulders when I'm riding the subway.
It's good.
People read newsletters.
Yeah.
That is for damn sure.
Yeah, you check it out at 6 in the morning. I'll walk around all the time and see people reading Morning Brew, reading The Skim, reading others. People, it's the best way to get concise news. There's no thinking. There's no thinking involved in me opening up my email and being there. I don't have to go on Instagram and scroll till I see that 12th post in between, 8 memes to find news. It comes right to me. It's curated. And that's why people always say, oh, newsletters are saturated. And people are going into newsletters. But quality newsletters will always be needed because humans are lazy, especially at 6 a.m. And what's a better way for you to look smart and kind of be smart than reading a 5-minute newsletter? And that's why these companies are thriving.
And now walk me through, I really believe in email. I think launching Monday Musings was the single best career decision I've made outside of starting to actually write mm-hmm. on the internet. What is so special to you about email, and why are you doubling down on the platform rather than saying, hey, we're Morning Brew, let's go diversify to Twitter, to LinkedIn, to Facebook, to Instagram? What is it about email that is so powerful to you?
It's just such an intimate experience. It's your personal inbox, and someone is sending you an email. You don't know how many other people are getting that email. Whereas on Instagram, you're scrolling, oh, a million people saw this video. Now, people know Morning Brew has a million subscribers, but it just feels so intimate. I open that email, and in between the email from my dad, my coworker, there's Morning Brew right there addressed to me. It's just something about it is intimate. I think podcasting, too. You really start to resonate with podcasting host voices. That's why I'm interested in podcasting as well. These are opt-in one-to-one experiences. I love one-to-one experiences. Email, it just feels like Morning Brew is writing to me. Podcasting, it feels like Dave Perrell is talking to me. Events are interesting too, because you're interacting in person with the company. You get outside of that though, and you watch a video on Instagram, it just feels like one to many. It's just a feeling. I understand that we send an email to a lot of people. It's not just you, but something about the inbox is just psychologically very intimate.
And then also the algorithm, right?
Yeah.
So what's nice about email is there isn't the same kind of algorithmic pressure where if you are on social and there's an algorithmic tweak, all of a sudden that could spell doom for your company. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording. You were saying, look, unless Gmail makes a massive, massive change, which we don't anticipate, we're going to be okay. So walk me through now. You're trying to grow. I want to really get into the dynamics of the referral program. I think it's fascinating, and I think that it's one of the growth hacks that you've really done some innovating around. I think that you seem to be really good at looking at what is fairly priced and then what is mispriced. And it seems like referral is sort of convoluted and tricky and difficult enough that it is mispriced and there's not a lot of competition there. Is that kind of how you think about it?
To some extent. We were certainly not the first people who had a referral program. Other newsletters had referral programs. PayPal had a referral program. It's really important to align what the prize is and what you're giving away with what the product is. So PayPal started this thing, and I believe it was you can get someone referred and give them five, and they get $5. And I think you get $5 too or something. And it made a lot of sense because it was a money app, money product, give away money. And I know for years people tried to emulate that, but it wasn't a financial product. And so if we gave away $5 for Morning Brew subscribers—
Or like free smoothies.
It'd be weird. Yeah, money's a weird thing. But yeah, to your point, free smoothies. So the first thing we give out three subscribers is Light Roast. It's more content. And people always say, why would I want more Morning—
Not coffee. Light Roast is a different newsletter.
It's our exclusive Sunday newsletter. You can't pay for it. The only way you can get our Sunday newsletter is if you get three referrals. And people who— People who we get questions all the time. Why is that the case? And it's simple. Who's going to refer their friends? It's the most passionate Morning Brew readers. Well, what do the most passionate Morning Brew readers want? More Morning Brew. So we're giving it to you. The next step is Morning Brew stickers. Why Morning Brew stickers? Simply, if you're going to share it with five of your friends, you may want something to put on your computer that says you're a Morning Brew fan. Also,
show that you read.
Exactly, yeah. To show that you read, show that you're educated. And for us, it's a very nice ROI. And we're not even factoring in any of that word of mouth marketing that who knows how we're factoring that in. But we align incentives. We've tested giving away random things like coffee. And it's not to say that we wouldn't do that again, but we want to make sure the prizes are aligned with the product. And so that's one thing. The next thing about the referral program is there's lifestyle in Morning Brew. Other companies who are, you could say, are more, let's say they're original content newsletters. They've tried referral programs and they haven't succeeded. And they come to me and say, why haven't we succeeded? There's no lifestyle. You don't want to share a newsletter, you're sharing the lifestyle, you're sharing the feeling of Morning Brew. There's conversational, it's a conversationally written newsletter. There's wit, there's tone. You're so much more likely to share that than sharing this dry, boring newsletter, no matter how high quality it is. So either you have something, you resonate with the voice, or you take it the other extreme, and it's so incredibly good that you must share it. But those are the two ways you get things shared, is it's above and beyond anything else. So, for instance, I tell so many people about Ben Thompson's newsletter because I think it's that good.
Yeah.
I think it is at least one order of magnitude better than anything else out there.
Yes.
Other than that, which very few, just by definition, very few things are an order of magnitude better than anything else, it's got to, you got to resonate with it. You have to really feel it. And that's what, that's why the referral program is so successful, is because people truly resonate with the voice and tone and they want to share it.
As you were building Morning Brew, how were you thinking about voice and tone? And I'll give you some context for that question. So one thing I want to do is by the end of 2020, I want to be a funny writer. Like, I actually think that there is huge edge in just adding humor to my writing, especially because it's a bit intellectual and can be a bit heavy. I want to pursue heavier topics, but then lighten that with humor. I think that the contrast is really good. You know who does a great job of this is Tim Urban at Wait But Why.
I was thinking about that when you said that. He's great.
He's great at it, right? Incredible. What you do is you pursue and study topics like artificial intelligence and Neuralink and career advice, like whatever it is. And then so you go really deep there, and then he has these childlike stick figures which just make you laugh as your eyes scroll down the page. And I think that so much of his success has gotten into actually combining the two things that you just said, the wit and the candid humor that you were talking about that Morning Brew aspires to, but then also the Ben Thompson-esque depth and difference, almost like you're fracking into the internet, you're finding a little cranny within it, and you're creating the only thing that's ever been there. So I want to hear about how you've thought about creating wit and some personality, and then what we'll do is we'll get into to the underpriced opportunity of non-person influencers.
Yeah. So I knew from day one I was not nearly good enough of a writer and not nearly witty and funny enough to write the newsletter. And that was from day one. I said, I can write. I'm decent. But if this company is going to be a massive media company, it's not going to be because I'm the face of it from a writing perspective. Mm-hmm. And so from day one, Alex and I could articulate – it's very difficult to articulate voice. It's hard to exactly describe what we wanted. The way we described it was, we want this to be written the way your friend who likes to go out but may not go out four times a week, may go out two times a week because on Friday night there's a TED Talk and they want to go to the TED Talk and network and meet some people instead of going to the Lower East Side for the third night in a row.
Yeah, another night at pianos.
Exactly, but that's what we – it's that guy or girl. It's – and not only is that guy or girl, but they're not telling you the news or they're not explaining you the news to you like you're in your boss's office. It's at a bar after work, your feet up on the bar, relaxing over a beer discussing news.
I love this.
And so while that's not – it's tough to give exact words to it. There's a feel to it. That's the feel we wanted. And it's very difficult to give that feeling to someone else. But our managing editor, Neil, is absolutely incredible. And every other writer, Kinsey, Duffy, a few other people, Eliza.
And you have this written down somewhere that that's exactly the feeling that you want to create.
Yeah, so Neil's built out a whole style guide. We have words. It's really gotten very detailed. And that's the ethos we want to give off.
I love how specific that is. I interviewed Nick Kokonis, who started Alinea, which 1 year after they opened, Gourmet Magazine ranked it the number one restaurant in America.
Yeah, he's got to get me a reservation.
And I asked Nick, so what happens when you first open a new restaurant? Because now he's opened other one, Royster, and he opened the Aviary Bar. And he said he does exactly what you do. He walks into the room where the restaurant's going to be, and he starts thinking and writes up, what is the experience that we want to convey? And then what you can do to get into the style is then you can map the style to the experience, because the style is a bit – it's kind of like a you know it when you see it thing.
Yep.
But the experience can be extremely tangible. And what you said about the person who goes out three times a week, two times a week, but then on Friday night would rather go to a networking event if it's a good one, that's so specific. And then that's like a foundation that then you can build up from.
Yeah, absolutely. And that didn't come to us overnight. And I knew I couldn't write in that wit when people ask what morning brew is, it's almost hard to explain in words. You have to read it. You have to
feeling.
Yeah, it's a feeling, and it's not articulated in general wit, conversational tone. That's what those are describing words. They explain what you're going to get, but it's a feeling, to your point, and you have to read a full issue to really understand. And at first, we tell people, we say, hey, it's a newsletter. But yeah, I read the New York Times. I read this. We say, no, it's different. And at first, people would say, yeah, sure, and they would never read it. But now we can say, yeah, we have a million subscribers, and then people say, oh, okay, clearly you have something here. Let me read it. And then I get a text, oh, I understand what you're talking about. This is so different than the way the Times talks to me. And I'm not criticizing the Times at all. I'm a very happy paying subscriber to the New York Times. But it's just different. It's unique. It's for different people, a different setting. And I think that's what makes us stand out.
So talk to me about non-person influencers and why you think that this is a super interesting opportunity.
Yeah, so it's interesting for us directly, but I think in general, I think influencers now are priced nicely. That opportunity's been explored. I think what is underexplored, and I don't have too many examples, I don't follow these that carefully, but it's the Instagram accounts, like the meal prep Instagram account. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're keto and you show yourself meal prepping keto meals every week. Or it's like the Humans of New York, or those accounts that it's not a person behind it. It's tough to monetize because you have this community of people, but there's no one person driving it. So no one really thinks, like, I launch a company, I want to do an influencer campaign, who do I hit up? If I'm huge, I hit up Kim Kardashian. If I'm kind of big, I'll hit up, who knows, maybe you, a rapper, Casey Neistat, you know? But rarely do you think, hey, let me hit up, Humans of New York.
Right.
And
right, but that has such a targeted audience.
Exactly. And there are some really good examples of this. There are some around job functions. So there are MBA Instagram accounts that are memes and funny, a lot of memes, but also just like funny, witty sayings that MBAs say. And you have to be within the know. But if you're in the know and you're an MBA, you get it.
You know where else you get this? You get this in, have you seen like Overheard in San Francisco, Overheard in New York?
Yep.
You could slot in something and say, maybe you want to do a Yankees ad or a Brooklyn Nets ad, and you slot it right into the caption, and it's super native advertising.
So I agree. I think that's the low-hanging fruit. I think the better opportunity is just to acquire it and say, we are done playing the I am buying Instagram ads game. I am going to build a brand around Overheard New York. I'm going to take Overheard New York, and they're actually big. They're doing this. But let's say they were smaller. Let's use them as the example, but let's assume they were a smaller Instagram account. I'm going to launch a newsletter. I'm going to build this entire media property around a single Instagram account. And then from there, I'm going to convert them to whatever I want. Now, it has to be a good fit. Mm-hmm. So Morning Brew would not buy Overheard New York, but maybe we would buy a MBA account. Maybe we'd buy...
Or Overheard on Wall Street.
Yeah. Or maybe there's one... Ramp Capital is big on Twitter. You know, those are, I think, opportunities that you start talking about content and commerce converging. Those are so underpriced because there are a lot of times they're side projects. It has to be the right one. You can't just go out and buy anyone. But to me, it's so interesting to play off not a personal brand, also a lot of less risk, right? Why? Look at Disney. They're not people. They're Mickey Mouse because Mickey Mouse is not going to get a DUI. And so I think there's an opportunity to roll some of these up. There are so many of them that if you can find the right ones for the right price, it's so interesting to roll them up. And to your point, they could be localized. So I follow one. The guy takes pictures of omakase in New York City. And I follow one. It's bagel shops in New York City. Right. What if you roll all those up and all of a sudden you have a combined unique million people who are all following the food scene in New York? Would that be valuable to the Food Network? Would that be valuable to a direct-to-consumer brand that's trying to expand in New York? And what would the ROI be on natively integrating ads or plugs on those channels? And how would that compare to just going out and competing in the open market and buying Instagram ads. And I think what you'd see is, given the quantity of them, if you can figure out the right way to evaluate them, there is a huge opportunity there, not in one, but in really rolling a bunch up and using economies of scale to create your ads across them, growth tactics, the fuck Jerry's of the world, or the there's Trash Can Tom, and that they're all owned by one company. They cross promote Barstool as well. They cross promote so well. And if you can roll up 15, 20 of these and run them efficiently, grow them all, and natively integrate your product in them, I think it's a huge opportunity that people are going to start going after.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the cheapest form of advertising is having multiple media units within a general entity and cross-promoting between them. So I want to get into, like, what are the axioms of the way that you think about growth? Like, if you're – if we could boil it down to, like, three principles, what do you think that they are? Because clearly you're seeing opportunities for growth in terms of rolling up Instagram accounts. You're seeing opportunities for growth in terms of launching different industry newsletters, in terms of growing Morning Brew from 100,000 to 1 million in 14 months or so. What are the principles that your philosophy of growth is built off of?
So let's start with building an audience. It's what you're doing. Irrespective of what you're selling, building an audience around the demographic of people you want to target is the most important thing. So for Morning Brew, no matter what we do next, we launch courses, we help people find jobs, we sell them products and services, whatever it is, we have this band of people in a very narrow, 20, median age 28 young business professionals. And if you really know that person, you can go out and get them, and you can acquire them, whether it's on newsletters or we just know where these curious people are. Mm-hmm. So number one is about knowing your audience. That's the most important thing, is knowing who you're targeting. If you're out there, and at first, of course, you're not going to really know your target demographic is, but finding out who it is as soon as possible is super important. Two, we talk about this a lot, I think it's content. Mm-hmm. It's not just ads anymore. You're not just going to be able to hit people with a Allbirds ad or a Away ad and convert them right away. And that's why they're all investing in content. Airbnb, mm-hmm. launching a magazine. Yep. And I don't think a lot of these are going to be successful. Not saying Airbnb won't be successful, because it's hard. But it's also hard to raise another $100 million and put that back into Facebook. So it's knowing your audience, building an audience. Two, it's content, and those play into each other. And third, it's being unique, what we talked about before. It's saying, how can I be unique, not just with my marketing, but with the actual product I'm creating from day one? How do I not create the 18th mattress company? How do I create something new, something innovative that is either truly 10x better mm-hmm. than the next best thing mm-hmm. and probably at least short-term, but probably long-term, unable to be replicated, right? Because if you do create a mattress, but someone else can come out with that 3 months later, a mattress in a box, it's tough to stay ahead of the curve. But I think it's all those things. It's the product and marketing, it's the audience, and it is being content first. And that's what's winning in the marketplace now, I think.
And how do you think about building a moat for Morning Brew? I mean, at this point, you're at a million subscribers. You have something going on. You own half the company. It's in a really good place. But it also seems like the kind of thing that I could see 5 years from now, somebody comes along and copies it and you're struggling a bit. But I also see 5 years from now, all of a sudden, you have used those principles that you just stated. You know your audience. You have an awesome product. You have habitual people who come to read Morning Brew every day. You have the content, which then you can use to ladder up to product, to ladder up to events, as you said. How do you think about actually building a moat? And so maybe we can start there, but then I also want to hear, who do you look to for other media companies who are actually doing a good job of this?
Yeah, it's all about quality of content. If we keep the content as high quality as possible, it doesn't matter what other people do. We're not the first email newsletter, and we're certainly not going to be the last. People have tried to knock us off. One exciting thing is we have scale now. So a million plus is a lot. That is a lot of people. And
what's great about email is you write the same email for one person as you do for a million.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of it. That's what we saw from day one is scale is beautiful with email newsletters. So if we create the best content, people have no need to leave. Creating more content is another thing. So not only are we creating general business content you need, but now we're going to create content in the industry in which you need to consume content for work. So if you work in emerging tech and you need to be knowledgeable about AI, blockchain, machine learning, we're going to give you that content. And so we can, and that's more B2B media. But if we can go in those directions, well, now it's a need. That's a double need. Not only do you need the content because you've opted into it, so you've at least said you want it, but you need it for work. But so that's the content side. But the company as a whole, to your point, we certainly don't want to just be a newsletter company. Mm-hmm. We don't even just want to become a media company. I just want to be a company. Mm-hmm. In 5 years from now, I want to have a very healthy ads-based business, but we want to have diversified revenue. I think one of the better examples of this is Barstool. Whether you love or hate their content, you have to admire the business they've created. Mm-hmm. They have podcast revenue. They have on-website revenue. They have Rough and Rowdy, so that's event revenue. They have Barstool Gold, which is subscription. They launched a golf tournament. They have other events. They have parties. Who knows? We probably only know half the stuff they have. Mm-hmm. They have 10 different revenue streams, and that is great to me. As being a diversified company, I would assume the majority of their revenue comes from advertising. We didn't even discuss commerce, by the way. They have a huge commerce business. Mm-hmm. I would assume the majority comes, or at least the majority of the margin, profit margin, comes from advertising. But if they lose, if direct consumers struggle in 2020, they lose some advertisers, they're okay because they can lean on their content arm. They can lean on the subscription. That's a healthy business, and that's where we're going to be in 5 years.
Okay, so you talked about the three general principles. How about in terms of how you get down to the tactics of, you've talked about the referral program. So it sounds like one of your big tactics is we want to focus on our actual users to be our referrers for us so that customer acquisition costs can go down. And we think that if we have the prize for giving referral, whether that be a special Sunday night newsletter, whether that be stickers, whether that be a t-shirt at the high end, what are some of the other tactics that you see or axioms of growth that you see down at the tactical level of actually growing a newsletter?
Yeah, great question. I will take a different approach to this. We've recently been really focused on retention. So for the longest time, it's been a race to scale and a race to increasing the top of funnel, not just for us, for everyone. Everyone's saying, oh, thousands, millions, tens of millions of customers. I do think there's a shift given how competitive the landscape is now. I think there's a shift to focusing on your best customers and saying, how do we generate the most revenue out of our best customers? How do we keep them around as long as possible? Mm-hmm. So that's what we're thinking about. How can we generate the most revenue from those people possible? And how can we keep them around as long as possible? The keeping them around as long as possible isn't that easy in email, but we have a few interesting things we're looking into, some retention tools that we've actually taken from some social media platforms, things like we talk about Snapchat streak for a while. Inverse actually does a great job of this. You know, you've opened 18 of 20 days this month. If you maintain a this percent open rate over the course of the month, we will put you in a drawing to win a prize. We will, you can do this or that or whatever it may be, incentivizing people to read more. Mm-hmm. My speculation is if you read more often, you're less likely to unsubscribe, you're less likely to fall off. Mm-hmm. And we are, as much as we talk about a million subscribers because that gets headlines, it doesn't generate revenue. What generates revenue is opens. Mm-hmm. We charge off how many people open the newsletter. Mm-hmm. So if we want, we could be at 5 million subscribers right now. We could buy a bunch of crappy subscribers. We don't do that because we focus on what's really important, that's that people consuming the newsletter. And so retention is a huge part. So that's lifetime, how long keep them subscribed. And then we think about, okay, well, if we have these people love Morning Brew so much, what else can we give them? Industry newsletters is one thing, but other forms of content. Do we launch a podcast? Do we launch events? That's ARPU. That's just revenue per user. That's revenue per the most engaged users, because your least engaged user is not coming to an event. It's going to be the person who loves the brand, wants to resonate with it. So we're looking more on that side of things. The top of funnel will come. Content first, more content, some PR and publicity, sure, all the general stuff. But I think as a whole, the D2C, which we are, like we're just, maybe it's free, we're a direct consumer company, we're a subscription. I think more and more focus now is going towards the back end of the funnel, specifically retention.
Okay, so as you look at other businesses across industries, we could go to restaurants, we could go to travel, we could go to fashion, whatever it is, what are some of the businesses that you look at and either you're inspired by, like they have a great experience, let's get outside of commerce, outside of media, or they just have a great business model and you're like, there's something about that business, the dynamics of the business, their moat, their subscription revenue model. Where are some of the businesses that you see and you're like, wow, that is a really interesting model?
Number one for me is Sweetgreen.
Sweetgreen.
You can't explain it. Something about Sweetgreen, it's just incredible. You go to their store, their app, whatever it is, it's just a seamless experience. When you order food to get picked up at 1 o'clock, it's not ready at 1:03, it's ready at 1. It's seamless. It's just better than their competitors.
Yeah, can you tell me, like, how do they make a better salad than just salad, than chopped? I mean, it's not even on the same playing field.
Yeah, it's a order of magnitude better. And it's hard to explain. The ingredients taste fresher. And I will fight. I'm actually, as of last week, I don't know if you saw, big news, officially black status on Sweetgreen.
Damn!
Yeah, so that's big time. It was exciting. We do team lunch, and I take all the credit for it. So that's how I got there. But I love it. That is one of my favorite brands. And you know, they raised the $1 billion valuation. So good for them.
I'll take what you said and see you one further. So there's a lot of things that Sweetgreen has done really well. And I actually went to Sweetgreen last week and spent my entire time in a conversation with a friend. We were going through the dynamics of the business. And so there's a couple things that they've done really well. They've done a great job making the feel and the experience of Sweetgreen feel like you're eating at a farm. So what they have is they have the wooden tables and the wooden chairs that you sit on that are actually pretty comfortable. They're definitely comfortable enough to do work in for an hour, and they make it possible to do work there because they have Wi-Fi. Granted, that's not the intention, but they make it very welcoming with the free Wi-Fi. There's no password to join. And then also with those wooden chairs, as I mentioned, it really makes it feel like you're actually at a farm and kind of hanging out in nature.
Yeah, they are really good. They are really good at what they do. It's just consistent. It's consistent across, you know, it's farm to table or whatever you call it, but you really feel it. It's not like, oh, in the corner we tell you where we get our chicken from. It really, to your point, and I didn't even pick up on that, but to your point, the wooden tables, the wooden chairs.
Right, because they show you, they have on the board, this is where all of our ingredients are from. And then the other thing is it's really well lit. So if you feel the lighting in there, none of the actual lights are harsh, but when you walk in there, it's always brighter than the outside. So you walk in and it has a kind of lightness to it.
Yeah, no, it's a great experience.
Okay, so we talked about Sweetgreen. Are there any other businesses that you think are really interesting?
Yeah, I'm a big Bonobos fan, the clothing company. And it's simply because for me, at least my fit, their pants are just better than anyone else's pants. Their website UI is the same, although the returns are great. Mm. I've heard some rumors that at least on Twitter, since they got acquired by Walmart, the customer service has gone down. I don't know if that's true, but what I've experienced is the pants just fit better than any other pants, and if you have a problem, I've been able to return it, no problem. And that's what you want from a clothing business. And so my shirt right now is Bonobos, my pants are, and I wear them most days.
You know, it's a serious flex because I was walking by Bonobos last night and I was looking at the aesthetic on the store and what they were advertising. And on one of the windows, they were advertising easy returns. And when you advertise returns, the subconscious intuition there is that our product is so damn good that you won't return it. They're daring you to return that product.
Yeah, it really is that good. And the store is great. Granted, I live 6 blocks away from it, so it's very convenient. But they have a sale or they launch new clothes. I go into the store, I try it on. You can't buy stuff there, but it's a very lean business model. It makes a lot of sense. I go home, put it in my computer, or I think you can order it there. They'll ship it to you. You can't pick it up there. And 2 days later, it's at your apartment. It fits. It's great.
I want to know where you see the email newsletter business going. I have an online course called Rite of Passage, and we are having all the students launch their own personal email newsletters. And I think that what's happened with platforms like MailChimp, platforms like Substack, which I use, is it's gotten really easy to publish an email newsletter, and it's such an effective way to reach people. And you don't need 10,000 subscribers for it to be affected. I had an email newsletter of 200 people, and amazing things started happening. So I think that even down at the personal level, email newsletters are going to get more popular, and that's something that we're really getting our students to do.
Yeah, I think people say it's saturated. It certainly is saturated, but there's a reason it's saturated. It works. And so from the personal level, there's nothing better. You could tweet and you could have a bunch of followers on Twitter, but still, why not pin a tweet about your email newsletter? Mm-hmm. You can be active on LinkedIn. I think LinkedIn right now my co-founder is very active on LinkedIn. The organic reach there is pretty insane.
And when we published our article, your post on LinkedIn flew.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. My co-founder posts on LinkedIn, he'll get 3,000 likes. And it keeps on coming and coming because people don't post that frequently. And people don't check it that frequently. So a month down the road, I'm still getting notifications. You got a like on this post. But email newsletters, I think, are the core to any successful personal brand or a media property. High level, I do think there will be some consolidation in the space. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of companies doing similar things. And I think whether it's someone rolling them up or companies trying to do multiple things and then rolling up others. So whether it's a media company rolling up multiple newsletters or a newsletter company rolling up multiple newsletters. But I think in general, some of the bigger players are going to be consolidated into larger organizations or combined. It's a very similar sale across multiple newsletters if you're an ad-based business. The tech is all the same. It's not hard to send two different designs. It makes sense that these businesses will be, consolidated. From the Substack standpoint, that's very interesting because to your point of it being great for your personal brand, I'm talking about the paid Substack especially.
Yeah.
There's so many writers out there who don't know if they're going to have a job tomorrow because of the mistakes that the founders and executive teams of these media companies made. BuzzFeed had layoffs, Vice had layoffs. And if you cover a beat and people care about what you cover, why not charge $5 or $10? I think what we're going to see is it can't go down. So a higher propensity to pay for written content, especially something you really care about. And I always think, I'll never pay for another newsletter. I pay for a bunch. And then someone comes out with another one.
Oh, yeah.
And once you're locked in, the churn rate has to be so low. Especially with personal newsletters, am I really not going to give this guy or this girl $100 a year who creates tons of content? Any of the newsletters I pay for, even if I don't read them very frequently, I would never consider not paying for them. What's going to be interesting is if someone can roll those up. Can someone roll up a bunch of paid newsletters and either bundle them together or go B2B and go to businesses and say, hey, what do you think about buying this Amazon newsletter? And let's go through some real examples. So can you want to buy Bill Bishop's Cynicism, mm-hmm, and Pomp's Cryptocurrency and a few of the other top ones?
David's Monday Musings.
Exactly, David's Monday Musings. Will they come together, the top 5 or 10 Substack writers, or top 50? Will they offer some sort of bundling? I think Substack's actually doing this themselves. They're going to try to do that to enhance revenue for everyone. But I think some sort of bundle there is really interesting.
And so for people who are a bit smaller, so let's go from the Bill Bishop's, yep, downwards. What are some of the things that they should be focusing on? And curious also if that's the same from when you were in the early days of building Morning Brew. Obviously, there's open rates. Obviously, there's just the raw number of subscriptions. I want to keep my open rate above 60% if I can. I think that's a really healthy number. But what else? Talk to me. What else should I be focusing on? What else should we as young, up-and-coming, emerging email newsletter subscribers be be looking at for metrics?
There are a few things, and I think it does depend if your newsletter is paid or free. But we can talk more generally about newsletters as a whole. I actually think that there are people out there who have newsletters who I follow on Twitter who I don't know that they have a newsletter. I think people are too shy about tweeting over and over again, sign up for my newsletter, sign up for my newsletter, and really getting the flywheel going. If newsletters are so important, how is your pinned tweet not about your newsletter? How is it not in your LinkedIn profile? If it really is the most important thing for you, it should just be there. It should be second nature. Tweets are exciting. I view tweets as top of funnel. Newsletters are bottom of funnel. Now, you have your paid writing course, and that's great. That's even further down the funnel. But no one is going to go from your tweet to buying your writing course. It's just not going to happen. Just like no one's going to go from a website to a paid product. They have to have an intermediary, which is either an app or a newsletter. And so I think you just needed to build the – obviously what you're doing is great with the Twitter and building your top of funnel, but you need more and more people in the newsletter because it's 60%. So you have a 6 in 10 chance of engaging with anyone who signs up with your newsletter, and then just tracking open rates over time. So we track metrics like how many times people open in their first 10 days, how many times people open their first 30 days, how many people open all 5 newsletters a week. Those are things we care about.
Nice. Right. So it just gets back to that engagement, that retention. Awesome. Austin Reif, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Hey again, it's David here one more time. Before you leave, I want to tell you about an online course I teach called Rite of Passage. In it, I'll show you how to accelerate your career by writing and sharing your ideas. I've taken everything I've learned from interviewing some of the world's most effective people on this podcast and distilled those lessons into a powerful set of principles for creating your own body of work. If you've always wanted to start writing online and build your professional network, this is the place to start. You can find out more on my website, Perel.com.